Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. If the reality of climate change ever hit home for me in a visceral way, it was late this summer when a series of wildfires erupted not far from my home in Northern California. I knew after the Camp Fire in 2018 destroyed my former hometown of Paradise, California, that fires are becoming both worse and happening later into the so-called fire season, which apparently is most of the year now. But this year was different. Fires erupted all up and down the West Coast, many of them sparked by a freakish series of dry lightning storms in August. One evening, I stood outside and watched as massive walls of flame erupted on the coast range of the Mendocino National Forest about 60 miles away. It was both awesome and terrifying to see. Then came the smoke, an acrid pall that trapped me mostly indoors with air purifiers running for weeks. It was horrible, and it hasn't really gotten better with one red flag warning following another as dry winds and soaring temperatures have continued deep into October. I wanted to find out how all this smoke is affecting us and why the forests are in such terrible shape, tinder dry matchboxes ready to ignite. So I reached out to some experts from the University of California, Davis. In this program, you'll hear from two forest ecology and wildfire experts, Malcolm North from the United States Forest Service and Andrew Latimer from UC Davis, about the state of our forests, past, present, and future. A little later on, pulmonary specialist Dr. Michael Skivo joins us to talk about the effects wildfire smoke is likely having on our lungs and health, especially in a time when COVID-19 also threatens us. Our first guest is Dr. Malcolm North. He's the principal investigator for the North Lab for UC Davis, which researches forest ecology and wildfire issues. He's also a U.S. Forest Service scientist based in Mammoth Lakes, California, and he joined us from there. While we were talking, smoke from the Creek wildfire west of him came pouring over the crest of the mountains. North joined us from his offices in Mammoth Lakes on the east side of the Sierra Nevada Range. Malcolm North, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And your specialty is, you know, forest ecology. And I'd like to ask you a question and kind of look at the big picture here through time. Describe for us what California forests looked like during the time, say, of John Muir, you know, when he was in the forests compared to now. What if we went back in time to around, you know, the late 1800s, what would the forests look like compared to now?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned John Muir because he has a quote that's well known about the general forest condition, in which he mentions that the forests had a lot of fire in them and because of that were fairly open and low density. In fact, he referred to the forests as being open enough that you could easily ride a horse through them. That's a very rare occasion in modern forests, but historically, we believe that generally in the pine and the mixed conifer, kind of the mid-elevation zones in the Sierra Nevada, you probably had something on the order of 50 to 80 trees per acre. And generally, we have 3 to 6 or even 8 times that number now.
And so that kind of begs the question, which I think I know the answer to, but I want to ask you, why? Why was it like that compared to now?
Before the arrival of Europeans and even into the early period of Europeans, the Gold Rush days and so forth, there was still a fairly active fire regime in most of these forests. Some of those ignitions were definitely due to Native Americans. Some were also lightning origin. But one way or the other, you ended up with most of these forests burning about every 8 to 20 years or so. And if you think about the fact that most of these fires stopped in about 1880 to 1900, you realize that the current condition of the forest, most of the forest has missed 5 to 6, if not more, fires going through to clear it out and reduce the fuel loads and also keep the tree density very low and the conditions very open.
And then piled on top of that, let's talk about the state of the forests. Like just before, look at like what it was like, say in June, before these fires began, for this year anyway. What are the forests like now, how stressed were they prior to all these lightning strikes and then the other factors that caused these fires?
Yeah, it's a great question, because we know that in generally the forests are, for a kind of a simple notion, but a lack of a better word, maybe is pretty unhealthy. Most of the times, as I mentioned, you have a lot more trees in the forest, and you have to think about trees kind of as just gigantic straws. They're very competitive for soil moisture, and that is by far the limiting resource in Mediterranean climate locations like California. And so we saw the consequences of that in the 2012-16 drought, where 150 million trees died in the Sierra Nevadas. And in many places, that has significantly added to the fuels problem we already have, the 5 to 8 fires that have been missed. And so you think about the amount of fuel that would have been there to begin with, and then you add on top of it dead trees, and particularly some of these trees are of good size, falling over and ending up on the ground. It really dramatically increases the intensity and the ferocity of the fire. And at least friends I have who are working on the Creek Fire, which is burning down here in the Southern Sierras, where much of that tree mortality was concentrated, they're seeing fire behavior which they have not seen before and is certainly beyond the current models that we have. And at least no one knows for sure, but a lot of the supposition is that the incredible fuel loads, particularly of all these trees that died during the drought, are really driving some of this exceptional fire behavior.
Yeah, and we're hearing that, you know, not just there, but all over the extreme fire behavior. And something interesting that you said that, you know, I want to really reiterate is that because of the tree density that we have from not having natural fires or set by indigenous peoples, we have greater tree density drawing up more water. And then you have a historic drought, which just dried things out even more because they're competing for, you know, more trees competing for less water, which is just a prescription for disaster, which is what we're seeing now. My next question is, you hear a lot about, we need to get logging back in the forests. You know, that's a solution, and perhaps it is, but what's your take on that as far as, you know, the reduction of logging that happened? Is logging the way it used to be done, or what's the healthiest way to approach this from a logging standpoint?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly when you hear people say we could log our way out of this situation, there are kind of two fundamental problems with that. I do believe there's a real important role for treating the forest mechanically with chainsaws in the appropriate way. Logging tends to have the connotation, though, of the way we used to manage the forests back in the actually the 60s through about the 1990s, in which most of the time when a forest was logged, they were removing the large trees. And the large trees are not the problem in the situation. In fact, in general, those are the trees you want to hold on to. They're the most fire resistant of the trees that are out there. And they're also where most of the carbon is stored in the forest, which is an important service that the forest provides to kind of offset global warming by sucking up and sequestering carbon as the trees grow. In a typical mechanical fuels reduction, you're mostly removing the small trees, what are often referred to as the ladder fuels, and trying to reduce the surface fuels. And if you picture that in your head, you can kind of immediately go, wow, there's not much money in that at all. In fact, that's almost always the case. And so to really reduce fire intensity in most of these forests, you have to remove material which, as the saying goes, cannot really pay its way out of the forest. It's too expensive to cut it, put it on a truck, and take it to a mill. And so in many cases, the idea of logging your way to a better forest condition is just not an appropriate means of treating the forest, because most of the tough work that needs to be done is in smaller sizes that are not commercially viable.
Yeah, it's just not an economically sustainable model for the actual timber industry.
Exactly. There are places in which you can get trees on sites that are really productive. And sometimes in those places, you can grow larger type of trees that actually should be removed, particularly to ease the drought competition, the water competition that leads to drought stress. But by and large, that's more of an effort where you're trying to make the forest more resilient to drought and the eventual bark beetles that sometimes come in and kill the trees afterwards. In terms of just the fire question, though, most of what you need to remove is this smaller material that can't pay its way out of the forest.
I'd like to ask you about what can we do after these fires to try to build towards a more resilient future for the forests?
Yeah, it's a great question. The first thing I would say, first and foremost, is that many of these fires are burning in a way which is not characteristic of the way fire burned in these forests historically. And because of that, it's creating conditions that the forest is not fully well adapted to deal with. And in particular, what I'm talking about here is that you have often concentrated areas of dead trees that are quite large. And conifers in California, conifers pretty much everywhere, reseed through wind dispersal. And we know that generally seed disperses about 200 feet in general, and you know, if you're lucky in the right conditions, it might go to 300 or 400 feet. But once you're more than about 300 feet away from a green tree, it's unlikely to get new seed coming into it to reestablish the forest. So one of the biggest problems we've seen over the last 20, 30 years as these fires have gotten more intense is that some of these places that were forest are not coming back as forests. They're coming back as chaparral, either montane or lower montane chaparral systems that have converted to brush. And those can be pretty intractable to change back to forest without either a lot of patience or a pretty extensive planting effort, which is what a lot of the focus is these days now on these really large, intense, high severity fire areas. The challenge there is that, frankly, we don't currently have enough money often to be able to grow the seed in nursery and to plant all of these areas. And many of them have an incredible amount of standing dead trees in them, or snags, which make it pretty hazardous to plant until those have fallen over. And by the time they fall over, the brush usually have a pretty good control or lock on the site. So a lot of priority has been put into thinking about how we could increase our planting effort and be smarter about the ways that we plant. Because traditional methods have generally focused on regular planting, often of pine trees, what even civiculturalists themselves refer to as pines and limes. And it's clear that one of the things we've learned over the last, just recently fairly, I'd say last decade, is that the spatial pattern of trees is important for their resilience to fire. And a regularly gridded pattern of trees is a recipe for them being vaporized in the next fire that comes along. So we've got to get some efforts going to try to create more complex tree planting patterns, particularly what is called a kind of a clumpy gap pattern in the forest, which has been shown to make the forest much more resilient to wildfire when it does occur. So certainly that's one of the big changes that we could really look at doing in the forest for the future is knowing that climate change is going to be driving more extreme fires. Fuel loads from fire suppression is going to be driving more extreme fires. And we need to make those forests, even when they're young, even when they're only like 20 years old, resistant to the inevitable wildfire that's going to come through.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said there, that these areas that were forests are converting to more chaparral, montane chaparral ecosystems, and that's more prone to burn. That's more, you know, those are plants that are adapted to burning all the time. So it would seem to me that you're going to have more wildfires in those areas. Is that Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. In fact, just within the last 3 or 4 years, we've had several studies documenting the fact that once an area burns at high severity in one of these really intense wildfires, it tends to reburn again at high severity. And it's a combination of the shrubs, just as you mentioned, and then the input of the dead snags, the dead tree boles that fall down and make the system very prone to when it burns to burning again very hot. The ecologists even have a word for it called hysteresis, which means simply that the system has moved outside of any range of variability it used to have in the past and is kind of now entrenched or stuck in a system in which it's never evolved with. And at that point, you're in a pretty serious ecological crisis, because you've really pushed the system into an alternative stable state that unfortunately is not what anything, either the animals or the plants, have evolved with.
Wow. Well, before we let you go, one last question. As somebody who spends a lot of time in the High Sierra, and, you know, and other places, I'm sure, around there, like the White Mountains, places like that, are you observing evidence that climate change is pushing the traditional zones, like, you know, the alpine zone and the tree line, that are you observing that those are going higher?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that the evidence that climate change is out there pushing on the system is pretty apparent and reasonably well documented in you know, increases in mortality and difficult, if not entire, failures of regeneration of species. The one thing I would caution is that the common notion has been that these plant communities will need to shift up in elevation or up in latitude to adapt to a hotter, drier climate. But we know from studying past communities through a variety of techniques that plants and forest communities actually tend to have very different combinations of species in the past when climate was different. And so I think that just thinking, well, if I'm in a mixed conifer forest, you know, it's going to have to move up about, you know, another 1,000 feet in elevation to deal with the climate, that's part of probably what's going to go on. But we're probably going to see a new combination of species and a new forest community. And that's the way these forests and these plant communities have always dealt with changes of climate in the past, is usually unusual and different mixes than what we currently have.
Well, Malcolm North, ecologist for the United States Forest Service, thanks so much for sharing your time and expertise with us on this, you know, incredibly complex and very important issue that we've all been dealing with up and down the West Coast throughout this terrible summer of wildfire.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at wildfires. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Dr. Michael Schivo. Dr. Schivo is a member of UC Davis Health and an expert in pulmonary medicine. I asked him to join us to talk about the effects that all of the smoke that we've been exposed to in the West is having on us. Dr. Michael Schivo, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
I just wanted to relate to you. We've had so many smoky days here where I live in Northern California. I live in Red Bluff.
Right. Absolutely. Yes, I have definitely noticed that.
It's been, you know, just kind of a nonstop horror movie of smoke.
Right.
Let's talk about what smoke actually is, you know, from your perspective. On the microscopic and even molecular level, what is in the stuff that we're breathing in?
Absolutely. That's a very good question. So smoke is really complex. And it contains particles of varying sizes, some of which you can see and many of which you can't see. And both are probably harmful. And as an example, when there's wildfire smoke, there's a lot of ash in the air. And a lot of people can definitely see that. It accumulates on your car, on your balcony, on your porches. And that in and of itself can cause irritation. It can cause irritation to the nose, to the eyes, to the throat. It can trigger people to have sore throats. And there are a number of things that people physically can feel just with relation to the ash that's in the air. But I think the more harmful substances are the ones that we can't see. So there's something called particulate matter 2.5. And what that literally means is it's particulates in the air, and they could be many different compounds that are so small, they're actually 2.5 microns in diameter or less. That is far, far smaller than what you would see on the head of a pin. Those are the ones that we inhale, and they can get deep into our lungs. So not just affecting the upper airway, like the throat and the main airways, but actually going all the way out to the furthest extents of the lungs. And those have been correlated with a lot of different diseases, including intensification or initiation of asthma, COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and causing what's called a pneumonitis, which is just an inflammation of the lung tissue itself. So those substances are very, very harmful. And over a long period of time, and I think we are talking about a fairly long period of time when we're talking about months of wildfire smoke, those can definitely cause damage. It's probably not clear how much damage in the long term, because that'll take years and years for people to really understand. But I have no doubt that they cause immediate damage.
And as far as the long-term damage goes, mm-hmm. is there some research being done? You know, are we collecting data on this as we go through, you know, year after year here in Northern California? This has been going on really since about 2012.
Yeah, absolutely.
With, you know, with all of us being exposed to wildfire smoke.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, most of the data actually comes from some of the fires that have been studied in Southern California, but there have been some studies on Northern California fires as well. It really doesn't matter, because wildfire smoke is generally pretty similar from region to region. But the most obvious consequences have been development and kind of worsening of asthma. When we're looking at things like COPD, and most people think of COPD as a lung disease related to long-term cigarette smoking. But when we look at things like COPD, my guess is that the particulate matter in wildfire smoke is going to lead to development of COPD in some people. It's just too soon for us to actually see that.
But what kind of time frame are you talking about? How long before we might see that? And, you know, what's your best guess?
So, you know, drawing from what we know about cigarette smoking, where people are smoking about a pack a day or a little more than a pack a day throughout the day, I would imagine that something like COPD would develop over probably about 20 to 30 years. Now, it's kind of apples and oranges, because people who smoke cigarettes tend to do it over the full 20 to 30 years, whereas wildfire smoke is kind of an intense exposure over a relatively short amount of time. But I do think that, you know, with the quantity of particulate matter in the air from these wildfires and the fact that it's gone on for several weeks, if not months, I would expect in the next 20 years, we're going to see some cases of COPD develop that probably are attributed directly to that wildfire smoke.
Well, what can we do as, you know, as everyday, you know, people to protect our health during these kinds of events? Because they're going to happen again. I mean, we're in a red flag warning as I speak to you right now. I can look out the window and I can see the north wind blowing. And I know everything is tinder dry all over California.
Right.
So, you know, the chances are we're going to go through this again before this year is out. What can we do to really protect ourselves as much as possible from these smoke events?
Sure, absolutely. And I get that question a lot. I'll take a quick step aside here and say that it's interesting because when there are hot, dry conditions, I don't think anyone in Northern California needs to be told that that's a potential for wildfire. I think we all know it now. And I think when the weather changes, every one of us kind of has a little bit of anxiety around that. And I've noticed that's been a change over the past several years. Getting to your question, though, about what we can do to prevent it, there are a couple things. One is sort of common sense, where we probably should limit our time outside. We should limit our time outside, certainly when we know the air quality is hazardous. I think everybody can agree on that. But paying attention to the air quality, and that is published on a number of different websites, which really looks at what is the concentration of those small particles. For people who are sensitive, meaning they have asthma, they have COPD, or they have any other type of lung problem, or frankly, any kind of major health problem like heart disease, they should pay attention and not go outside, even when the air quality is moderate. So when the air quality is moderate, most people can spend an amount of time outside and probably not register any damage. But if someone is really sensitive, they should avoid going outside altogether if it's nothing but good air.
Yeah, I noticed for myself, when things got bad, I'm fortunate because I had the foresight to buy some air purifiers, air filters, and, you know, set those up in my house and have those running and have everything shut up. And I have, you know, an air conditioning system, which also, I believe, doesn't that also help filter your air when you're running your air conditioning?
It can a bit. It certainly can filter out the large particles. It's a little bit less efficient at filtering out the really small ones unless you have a HEPA certified one.
Yeah, yeah, that's, and we do have that. But so running all those air purifiers all constantly and staying inside, which gets depressing after a while. You get tired of being indoors, but you have to do it. Mm-hmm. But even then, you know, I would notice I would go to dust, and you know, there's this weird film that's not normal dust.
That's,
you know,
right.
What's in all that stuff? That's all those particles you were talking about.
Yeah, and those are probably more the larger particles. Again, those are the ones you can see. Those are more made up of ash. And so wearing a standard face mask when you're dusting or blowing out all that stuff off the porch, that probably will help a little bit because those particles are larger. But I get a lot of questions about what can people do to cover their faces to filter out the really small particles. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult because unless you have a very high quality face mask that has HEPA registered filters on them, those very small particles are difficult to filter out. So that's why, you know, I recommend that people avoid going out, especially if they're in a sensitive group. But if they are going to go out, they make sure that they invest in a good high quality mask with an HEPA filter.
Yeah, and of course, we're all concerned about wearing masks, which leads me to my next question.
Sure.
What about the double whammy here of people, you know, contracting COVID, which attacks your lungs, and also having breathed in all the smoke?
Yep.
You know, what are you guys seeing about that?
Yeah, okay, so I have a lot to say about that. So a couple things. Number one, we do know that wildfire smoke in particular increases people's susceptibility to respiratory viruses. This has been shown with influenza in particular. Although we don't have any direct link between increased susceptibility to COVID and wildfire smoke, it just stands to reason that if someone's breathing in a lot of wildfire smoke and getting the inflammation in their lungs, that they might be more susceptible to contract COVID. Now, again, I don't have anything to prove that at this point, but there is data with influenza. So I'm kind of borrowing that data. The other part of that is my guess would be that, you know, because we know that anybody with any chronic conditions, including chronic lung disease, who develop COVID or who contract COVID, they tend to have worse disease. They tend to be the ones that get sicker. And so it would sort of stand to reason that if someone has inflamed lungs to begin with, contracts COVID, they probably have a higher likelihood of getting sicker. So that's one thing. The other thing that's kind of unique about this is, you know, a lot of places undergo mandatory evacuations when fire is close. And there's a great concern about what happens to the evacuees. You know, where do they go? Where, what type of centers are they able to go to? And knowing that COVID tends to spread more readily when you have a large group of people together, that's a big concern that people who are evacuated may be more susceptible to contract COVID because they're with a lot of other people. Now, we haven't seen that per se, but that obviously is a pretty major concern.
For healthy people, especially younger people, what are some of the mechanisms in the human body that help to get rid of this stuff? Like once you've been exposed to a lot of smoke for, you know, a relatively short period of time, and then of course you are not going out in, you're not a smoker and you're not doing anything, and then you're breathing clean air. What mm-hmm. does your body do to kind of detoxify and get rid of this stuff?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So the lungs themselves and the body in general are remarkable organs. And we do have many, many compounds in our blood. We have many, many mechanisms to help sort of rid the body of toxins. The lungs in particular, when they're left undisturbed, meaning you're not breathing in that smoke anymore, they have a lot of ways to take larger particulate matter and literally kind of sweep it out of the lungs. The lining of the airways can actually can trap particles and literally sweep them up until we can either cough them out or swallow them. So that's one way that we sort of get rid of that. The other is the immune system, which is remarkable in and of itself, can activate and over the long term can activate what's called the adaptive immune system to specifically fight certain kinds of compounds. These are the same mechanisms where the body deals with virus infections, bacterial infections, or any foreign substances that make it into the airways. So, you know, over time, we do have the ability to clear out a lot of this stuff. And hopefully, we don't incur too much damage along the way. The advice that I give to people is stay as healthy as you can. Stay as healthy as you can and optimize your chance of letting your body work to rid itself of toxins, of infections, of everything else.
Well, on that note, and that's great advice from a doctor that we should all follow, Dr. Michael Scivo, I appreciate you sharing your expertise with us, talking about, you know, the deleterious effects of all of this wildfire smoke that people all over the West have been dealing with this summer. So thanks for your time.
Okay, Dave, thank you very much and stay safe.
Thanks to Dr. Michael Scivo from UC Davis Health. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at wildfires in the West. And we're back. Let's return our attention to the forests and talk to an expert on wildfire and forest ecology. Andrew Latimer is a professor in the Department of Plant Sciences at UC Davis, and he joins us from there. Andrew Latimer, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Dave.
I'd like to start out by asking you, you know, as we've gone through this just incredible summer of wildfire, and seeing what's happened, especially in the Coast Range with the August complex and how much of that has burned, you know, you've probably seen in the news, you know, all the stuff. It's like, this is because of climate change. No, this is because of forest management. Could you give us your take on, you know, why are we seeing this unprecedented amount of wildfire in California in 2020?
Absolutely. Yeah, Dave, that's a question I've heard a lot too. You know, because the amount of area burning this year is just so huge, it's kind of off the charts of what we've experienced over the past century, at least. We're trying to wonder what's changed. You know, why has this suddenly popped up? And I think the first thing to think about is to realize is this is, even though this year is off the charts in terms of the number of acres burned, it's also a continuation of a trend that's been going on. We've had a number of big years, big fire years recently, more big fire years than not, really. And so why is that? And it really, there's this old construct that I think is pretty useful that fire researchers use called the fire behavior triangle. And it basically, it's kind of one of those slides you'll see in a fire ecology or fire science lecture that says, look, it's fire behavior is really driven by three main things: fuels, fuel loads, and fuel composition, by topography, how the landscape's actually laid out, whether a fire's burning uphill or downhill, and the weather. And of course, weather, you know, climate is the averages of weather over a long period of time. And we're seeing not changes to topography, but we are seeing changes to both. We've seen big changes in the last century in both fuel loads and climate, or the distribution, especially of extreme weather events, including really hot, dry periods. So, I mean, the short answer, which I probably should have started with, is definitely both. And these fires, most of these fires this summer, including that August complex, which is so massive, aren't that surprising when you consider what the situation was when they started. What's more surprising is to take into account that those conditions existed in the first place, and that at the same time, you had a bunch of other fires burning all up and down the coast, throughout California and even up into Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, because we had, you know, all of those lightning strikes in August, that dry lightning storm that, you know, kicked this all off. And then, and like you said, you had fires, you know, all throughout, you know, Northern California, Southern California, Central California, the whole state, you know, had fires. And there's, you know, there's only so many resources to go around as far as fighting those goes. I'd like to shift gears, though, a little bit and talk to you about the overall health of the vegetation in these wild areas, because it just seems to me, observing it for myself and looking at it over the years, because I started to notice this really around the turn, around 2000, that things just looked like they were getting much drier as I would go on backpacking trips or hiking trips into the mountains. You know, browner looking leaves earlier than before, you know, things were drying out quicker. You know, for me, the whole fire thing really started to hit me in 2012 with the Reading Fire in Lassen Park.
Which was
when I saw my first, you know, that's a weird looking cloud, a pyrocumulus cloud. Now they're normal. You see them all the time. But I'd like to know, you know, how is the vegetation doing? You know, it seems like it's very stressed by drought and increasing temperatures.
Yes, you're right. I mean, so I think it's really interesting actually to hear that you had that impression as long ago as 2000, the year 2000, the time period where it really, I think, jumped out at most people, including me, that a lot of the forests were getting really stressed for lack of water was in the big mega drought we had from 2012 to 2015 or 2016, depending where you are in the state. That was really sort of a record-shattering drought. And the reasons why that drought led to so much tree mortality is the simplest version of that is that temperatures are higher. Because, and why I say that is that California, anyone who's lived here for a while knows we go through these periodic droughts. The rainfall is very variable year to year, and even over, you can get consecutive periods of a few years with a lot of rain, consecutive periods of a few years with very little rain. Back in the late 70s, there was a big drought. We had other droughts in the late 60s, kind of a milder drought, 2007-08. And then we had this really exceptionally big one, 2012, 2015, 16. And that's not a new pattern, that rainfall is very variable. Although that may be in an intensifying pattern, and some of the climate science suggests that we'll see more of these really low rainfall years or short series of years. But at the same time, as we've always had a lot of rainfall variability, when the temperature is going up, the combination of higher temperatures and low rainfall is the thing that really stresses ecosystems, because the higher the temperature is, the greater evaporative demand there is sucking water out of the vegetation.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out that it's not just, you know, when you say rising temperatures, I don't just look at, you know, what was the high temperature. It's the overnight lows that are creeping up that alarm me. And I'm wondering what kind of effect that has on the plants.
Yeah, great point. I mean, that's a really cold temperatures also affect plant development. When the temperatures are warm at night, it causes the plants to use more sugars up during the night, kind of burn through their stored resources faster. It also has effects even in fruit trees, and particularly they need a particular amount of chilling, a certain number of nights of chilling to even flower properly and set fruit. So there are parts of the Central Valley that are starting to become unsuitable for some of the historical orchards they've supported because the nighttime temperatures are getting warmer.
Let's talk about after these fires, and I'd like to look at this on time scales short and long. After a big fire like this, I know like you have the Stebbins Cold Canyon Reserve, which is part of the incredible UC natural reserve system. Is that you go into a place like that that burns, and then, you know, what do you observe in the short term about the recovery of a place like that, or a place like the Paradise Ridge area after one of these big fires? What do we observe as far as the recovery of the natural world, the vegetation and the wildlife, you know, post-fire?
Yeah, that's great question. And thank you. I appreciate it. It's great that you mentioned Stebbins Cold Canyon, which is one of the reserves that UC Davis runs and is a really popular hiking spot for many people. And that just burned. It had burned previously in 2015 in a really what looks now like a tiny little blip on the map compared to these large fires we're having, but did burn the entire reserve in 2015. And so it's repeat burned now, 5 years later. The thing about that landscape, which is chaparral, grassland, and oaks, it's kind of this coast range, pretty warm climate vegetation. It's very resilient to even really intense wildfire. And I actually really was curious after the 2015 fire whether some of the shrubland areas and grassland areas would bounce back. And even knowing that those plants are really evolved to deal with high intensity fire, which is pretty much what's expected periodically in those kind of ecosystems. And so the plants that live there are pretty well able to deal with it. I still thought that you might see some failure to recover in part of that site, because as we just talked about, there was this really intense drought leading up to that wildfire, 2012 to 2015. So I thought plant resources, plant starch storage levels, basically how much food they've laid aside, might be kind of low because they've been stressed by the drought. And then they were hit with a really hot fire that burned fairly slowly. A lot of the reserve, it was backing down slope, and a fire burns more slowly as it's burning downhill with a lot of fuel. So it's heating up the soil a lot and killing some of the seeds in the seed banks. So I went out and informally surveyed to see whether some of those shrubs would fail to resprout, would have just been exhausted by the combination of drought and wildfire. And there were a few, there were definitely maybe 5 or 10% of the shrubs that didn't come back, but the overwhelming majority were perfectly fine and were able to resprout. And the grasslands were, you know, the greenest I've ever seen them the year after that fire. So those ecosystems really are the default almost all the time. Not every time. If you get fire that's too frequent, if fire every other year in a system like that, will start wearing away at the populations of plants and shifting what kind of vegetation can grow there. But even really hot fires, like have occurred so far at Stebbins Cold Canyon and in so many other parts of the Coast Range, those vegetation types, chaparral and grasslands and most oak woodlands, are really resilient to that.
Well, and they're evolved to burn.
Exactly.
Finally, back to climate change and long-term timescales. I saw that there's some studies about the world's oldest living trees, the bristlecone pines, mm-hmm. and that they are at very high elevation in like places like in the White Mountains in Eastern California and throughout the Great Basin. And they're amazing trees, thousands of years old. But I'm seeing, you know, that there's some interesting research going on about them and how they are not able to deal with climate change. And they can't migrate the way other plant species can.
Right. Yeah. There's a UC Davis grad student did a study looking at tree line shifts in the Great Basin forests. And those are those really dry mountains to the east of the Sierras where the rain shadow makes them very dry. But when you get high enough in elevation, those mountains like the White Mountains in southeastern California catch enough rainfall and snow, mostly snow, to be able to sustain a low density of trees. And as temperatures have gone up, that actually allows the tree line to move up those mountains. Despite it being pretty dry, pretty cold, moderate the cold a little bit, the tree line could move up. And how quickly the trees move up, what we found was there's some species that are able to just jump on that change because their seeds are moved so quickly by birds. And other species, including the bristlecone in particular, seems to be kind of lagging. And because everything bristlecones do is in slow motion, it's not necessarily a problem for them. Those living adult trees will last potentially thousands more years. They've got a lot of time to catch up, but their initial response has been slow. You know, so far for the bristlecones, a very slow, deliberate life style is kind of suits them well. They're very resistant to disease, very resistant to drought, very resistant to bark beetles, although some of them apparently have been attacked recently. So they've got some time to catch up.
Wow. They're amazing, amazing species, the bristlecone pines. Well, it's interesting to talk to you, and we could spend a lot more time on this, but I'd like to end on what do you see as, like, you know, as somebody in your field of study looking at the climate change situation we've got going on, the droughts we've been experiencing, which are a part of that. They're a natural part of California's climate to begin with, but they seem to be intensifying, these rising temperatures overnight and during the day. And then these mega fires. What are some of the things that you are, you know, focusing on as a researcher going forward? What are some of the big questions you're trying to focus on?
Yeah, what I'd really love to be able to know is just how will the mountains, how will the forests, how will the ecosystems of California look in 50 years and 100 years? And these are really complex questions, as you're suggesting. But a couple of things I'm really interested in. One has to do with responding to the fires and where, to the extent that we want to start nudging these ecosystems in the direction we want them to go, it's inevitable that a lot of them will change pretty dramatically as climate changes and as they're hit with increasing disturbance through fire and other factors like bark beetles. What are the best ways that we can intervene and give them a push in the direction we want? So, for example, we have an ability to plant, you know, something like tens of millions of trees a year in forests, based on the amount of capacity we have to grow seedlings and then get them out there. Where does it make most sense to do that? And where shall we kind of plan those forests to be the ones that will do well in a climate that's considerably warmer 50 years from now? So those are things I'm really actively looking at, experimenting with different ways of planting trees, trying to figure out which kinds of tree planting methods work well and which don't. And the other question I'm really intrigued and diving into right now is, because the combination of computation and remote sensing, we can look at fire spread in a much more detailed way than we've done before. So this is circling back to not so much the response of the ecosystem, but what's driving the fire behavior, and particularly the behavior when fires move extremely quickly. Something like about 40% of the area burned in these wildfires we've been experiencing happens in only a couple of days in each fire. So there's a couple of days where the fires are really exploding across the landscape. And sometimes it's obvious why. The wind's really strong and it's really dry, or the fire created a pyrocumulus cloud and generated its own weather. But if you look across thousands of fires and each fire is burning for tens to dozens, hundreds of days, there's a lot of individual little increments of fire we can look at. And we can recreate basically where a fire has burned every single day for each fire that's burned in California forests for the past 50 years or so. And from that, all of that information, I'm really interested in trying to figure out what combinations of factors lead to that excessively fast, extremely fast fire spread rates that are so dangerous and can be so destructive to forest ecosystems.
Wow. Well, on that note, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, great.
It was fun to talk to you, and good luck with your work and your students there at UC Davis.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks again to all of our guests, Malcolm North from the United States Forest Service, Dr. Michael Stevo from UC Davis Health, and Andrew Latimer, an ecology researcher and professor at UC Davis. We'll continue to look at climate change and its role in wildfires in the future. For now, stay safe, and if you live in a fire-prone area, get as much defensible space around you as possible and join me in hoping for what has turned out to be a very elusive quantity here in California, rain. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented and very dry Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.